At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
The New World Report with Professor Evan Ellis of the U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute. Cuba. The Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962 is a moment in the Cold War where things became extremely, extremely dangerous. The Kennedy administration knew a deal of the attempt by Nikita Khrushchev to put medium-range missiles capable of reaching all of the east coast of the United States in Cuba, all of them capable of carrying a nuclear warhead. The Kennedy administration did not know in his confrontation with Russia that Cuba also possessed Soviet units that deployed Iskander missile systems, the same Iskander used today in Europe or deployed in Europe. Those Iskander missile systems also had the capability of firing tactical nuclear weapons. Nobody knew this at the time, nor did anybody know at the time that there was a moment when a Russian submarine carrying a nuclear-tipped torpedo came very close to opening fire on a U.S. flotilla. That was then. Here we are, 59 years later, and while we do not have a missile crisis, we do have a Cuban crisis, if to follow my understanding of this headline in the Wall Street Journal. Beijing plans a new training facility in Cuba, raising prospect of Chinese troops on America's doorstep. Professor, a very good evening to you. As was said in the Cuban Missile Crisis to explain to the American public in October of 1962, Havana is 90 miles from the American coastline. The Cuban government is in trouble because of its failed economy, because of its failed policies, because of the persecution of its people. But Chinese troops changes Cuba into the front line of a contest with China. What does this mean for policy in Washington, for your understanding of the defense of the United States, that 90 miles away could be a Chinese combat unit? Good evening to you.
Good evening, John. Well, certainly, as you pointed out, what has happened with China and Cuba right now is not in strategic terms the same as the deployment of nuclear missiles pointed at the United States with that short-range warning. However, it is very worrisome, both in terms of what it indicates that China is willing to do in the hemisphere and the risks that it's willing to take, even if it believes that its moves will be secret, as well as the desperation in what Cuba is willing to risk. So, two separate incidents, both of which surfaced, of course, during and slightly before Secretary Blinken's trip to Beijing. The one really was a confirmation of what Latin Americanists have followed for quite some time, which was the rumors that Cuba had acquired access to a U.S. listening post that was operated by the Russians during the Cold War. Perhaps it acquired that access as long back as 1999, but certainly had apparently upgraded that access, confirmed by the Biden administration, in around 2018, 2019, and maybe taking farther steps. That is important both in terms of peacetime and potentially in terms of a conflict, because it allows Cuba, or allows the Chinese in Cuba, to potentially capture signals, whether it's on U.S. installations like Jato South or maybe U.S. Southern Command or other installation signatures on U.S. warships and other facilities that can basically be used against the United States in time of conflict. But in addition to that, the latest revelation was that Cuba, also run by the Wall Street Journal, is allowing China, or at least is negotiating the prospect of allowing China to send U.S. military personnel rotationally training. Now, while that is only a small threshold, it's a very important threshold because it raises the prospect of a permanent or semi-permanent group of Chinese troops in Cuba, and also a increased level of collaboration. And so while the training itself may not be dangerous, or at least as dangerous, but the possibility of at least that can be used as a cover for Chinese special operators and teams and others who could launch from Cuba to do various things against U.S. deployment in other locations. So again, it's not quite nuclear missiles pointed at the United States. And even if China thought it was going to be able to keep the secret, it's really worrisome because it suggests that China is willing to take risks that heretofore, in terms of other military engagement, like donation of armored vehicles to police forces or bringing people, military leaders over to Beijing. It really kind of goes beyond that, just, you know, friendly, you know, training and relation type of things. It's not quite China looking for permanent bases, but it suggests that China may be willing to also take risks elsewhere in the hemisphere. And frankly, as with Cuba, elsewhere relatively close to U.S. shores and strategically sensitive locations.
The People's Republic of China is allied with the Russian Federation in terms of Ukraine, in terms of developing Eurasia. At the same time, we have these headlines, these reports of China with troops and a listening post in Cuba. We have this headline from the Associated Press. Cuban officials conclude Russia trip with agreements on oil, wheat, and renewed tourism. What do they want from Russia?
No, it's a great question, John. This is a complement to what we see with Cuba's willingness to basically take money from China in return for risky military access that could provoke the United States. Because traditionally, although Cuba has certainly been a friend of other illiberal regimes, you know, Russia, Venezuela, China, etc., it is because of its memories of that Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, Cuba's been a little bit more reluctant to allow extra hemispheric actors to use Cuba to project their own threats into the region, especially when Cuba has very little to gain. What we're seeing here is that Cuba, with a number of different actors, is looking for whatever way it can to overcome these record levels of food shortages and medical shortages and fuel shortages. So with Russia, we see that, there was a trade delegation that came to Havana from Russia. And it was interesting, 30 trade agreements in which Cuba really seemed to be willing to give Russia a number of things that Cuba really doesn't usually give in terms of extended leases on land, in terms of accelerated repatriation of profits, deferral of paying taxes to the Cuban government. In addition to that, this also complements what you saw with the visit of Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi and his defense minister, who came to Cuba as well as to Nicaragua and into Venezuela. And again, once again, that the talk was possible oil deals or and food deals. So, of course, Cuba is also sending military forces to Belarus, which once again, it appears that Cuba is looking for whatever collaboration that it can with illiberal partners in the region to help it overcome some of the things that are producing this record crisis. And that also suggests that, Cuba is increasingly putting its eggs in the basket of illiberal players, believing that it's probably not going to get too much more from making nice with the Biden administration in the United States or, for example, attracting European tourists.
Now a puzzle. I know very little about the Cuban president, Miguel Díaz-Canel. The Castros are gone and Díaz-Canel is said to be firmly in control. However, all of a sudden, Vatican City, within these last hours, Pope Francis held talks with Cuban President Miguel Díaz-Canel, who was making a rare trip to the West as police kept a small demonstration demanding respect for human rights on the island away from the Vatican. A Vatican statement did not give any details on what was discussed during 40 minutes of talks, but says that the Cuban president's subsequent talks with the Holy See diplomats, the topic was the current situation in Cuba, mentioning the Cuban church's charity activities. My understanding is that Catholic activists in Cuba have been persecuted over the years. Is this a concern for the Vatican? Does this make Díaz-Canel acceptable as a representative of a country that persecutes Catholics? I'm confused by this news because Díaz-Canel runs, as my information, runs a series of prisons that persecute people for their politics, especially their politics and religion.
Absolutely, John. For me, the Vatican has long played a very delicate game of negotiation with a number of different dictatorships and communist regimes. And the concern, as I understand it, has always been, the religious liberty and well-being of the church and those who practice Catholicism within the region. And so we see this in terms of the Vatican's delicate negotiations with the PRC in terms of the rights there. We see this in terms of the Vatican's negotiations, with Nicaragua, which has openly persecuted the Ortegas, bishops, the case of Rolando Alvarez. And so what I suspect is that, this very much had to do with, an opportunity for the Vatican to talk about the well-being of those practicing Catholicism in Cuba, fundamentally a deeply Catholic country before it was taken over in 1959 by the communists, by Fidel. However, any range of other things that could have been talked about, whether it's, Cuban leverage with the Ortegas in Nicaragua, and also the question of what Diaz-Canel thought that he had to gain by going all the way to the Vatican to have these conversations. Was Diaz-Canel looking for greater access to funding or financing of some sort, from the Catholic Church? It's clear what the interest of the Vatican was in this dialogue, but what's not clear is why Diaz-Canel went all that way to meet with the Pope. And it may, again, reflect the level of crisis and a crisis of legitimacy that Diaz-Canel perceives that he has in Cuba right now.
Just a note, Professor, because I've not followed the story carefully. Diaz-Canel, does he project himself as a communist or a Catholic? Does he say anything about his spirituality?
My understanding is that he has always projected himself as a communist, a loyal party apparatchik. He had to maneuver within the party really to receive the support of those who had been part of the Raul Castro and the old Fidelista factions within Cuba, the military, etc. And so none of that implies loyalty to Catholicism, and it's not at all about popular votes and traditional sentimentalities. So my understanding is that this has very little to do with any affiliation with the Catholic Church that Diaz-Canel himself may have, and all to do with the continuing struggle of the communist government to maintain itself in power and overcome its crises.
Professor Evan Ellis of the U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute. We're going to Central America. There's tragedy. I'm John Batchelor.